I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one imagines a walk around the Massachusetts Institute of Technology with the late, great Isaac Newton. Newton, the 17th century English math and physics genius who, in the miracle years of his early 20s, figured out almost everything you and I know about planets and moons and apples in motion and gravity and calculus, MIT, of course, being a vast sort of extension of Newton's imagination. More Newtonian, you could argue, than he was. So, who would Newton find at MIT these days to talk about his really favorite subject, God, and alchemy, the science that might turn base metals into gold? And what would Newton make of the brain sciences today, of nanotechnology, of the genome? Might he draw the line at the hot so-called science of evolutionary psychology? We're talking here, in fact, with Thomas Levinson, who runs the course on science writing at MIT. His new book tells the story of Isaac Newton's fight to the death with the notorious counterfeiter of coins, William Chaloner, who took the mixing of metals to the level of high crime and paid for it. I'm asking Tom Levinson to bring Isaac Newton up to speed, so to speak, a fast forward of about 300 years.
Isaac Newton, we look back on him, I certainly do, as the foundational scientist. But Newton himself was not a Newtonian. He was, you know, young Isaac Newton, born so puny they waited to name him for a few days so that he would survive, a rural kid on a farm. And it turns out, as a mature thinking man working at Cambridge and then later, engaged in a whole range of pursuits, some of which we clearly recognize as part of the Newton that we make a myth out of, and some of which seems, you know, more and more strange to us. He was, for example, an alchemist. That conveys ideas of, you know, magic and craziness and fraud. Ben Jonson's play The Alchemist, written, you know, many years, but in several decades before Newton was born, is all about this kind of fraud. But also in Newton's time, it was something that was pursued by extremely respectable people like Robert Boyle, thought of as the founding chemist, John Locke, the great political philosopher, and of course Newton himself. And for Newton, alchemy was partly practical chemistry. He was an extraordinarily precise experimentalist. This, you know, man we think of as being all mind could actually use his hands and build furnaces and boil potions and measure things incredibly accurately. He was this extraordinarily broadly engaged person. And Newton's largest objective, the one to which basically all of his other activities, you know, worked to advance, was as somebody who wanted to understand as deeply as he could, down to the bone, how it was that the all-consuming God to which he devoted his life organized the universe, set the universe in motion, was present physically in the universe, intervened in it in space and time. He wanted to understand, to use Stephen Hawking's now I think somewhat unfortunate phrase, Newton not just wanted to understand the mind of God, he felt he could.
It comes through in your book, Tom, that Isaac Newton felt somehow that the people who were mixing metals for the wrong reasons, for purely fraudulent commerce, were almost blaspheming the science that he thought was legitimate, alchemy. Does that explain some of the fervor of his prosecution here?
I think it does. But I have to say that that's inference on my part. I think it's inference from very sound principles, from a sound base. But here's the story. The wardenship of the mint was supposed to be a no-show job. There's even a letter from the guy who was offering it to him, to Newton, saying, you basically don't have to be there. You don't have to come to the Tower of London, which is where the mint was housed at that time. But Newton being Newton, he took over the industrial process of reminting 7 million pounds worth of silver with extraordinary precision. He did time and motion studies. He calculated how fast a team of men could work. He understood how to use the 50 horses owned by the mint to drive the machines, all this kind of stuff. And from a starting point before he got there of complete disarray, he saved the recoinage. It's called the Great Recoinage, this remaking of England's currency, and brought it in, you know, on budget, ahead of time, I mean, he was credited really with the saving of the situation. And at the same time, he initially had hoped to avoid dealing with the problem of counterfeiting. It was messy. It was grubby. It caused him to sort of face the calumny of those he arrested in court. The court system was set up in such a way that he didn't win every case, and Newton hated to lose. I mean, he hated contradiction. But at the same time, as you say, I really think that when you think about what counterfeiting is, you know, alchemy, you try to isolate and control and reproduce the action of the divine spark, the vital energy that transforms baser metals into purer ones until you arrive at the secret that allows you to transform base metals into gold or the philosopher's gold. Alchemy is thus a study that is both scientific, you're trying to understand a natural process you think exists, this transformation of metals, and an act of sort of practical theology, understanding how God works in the world, how God's creation occurred, how transformation still occurs. Counterfeiting, you take base metals, you take pewter, you take silver, you gild it with gold, you mix things up, you give something the appearance of value without its substance. And he comes into a situation where he has to confront counterfeiting as a threat to the security and just economic health and well-being of the nation. And in particular, he comes up against a notorious counterfeiter, the man who is the other focus of my book, William Chaloner, who says that he knows better than Newton how properly to make coins, says that in front of Parliament. I think it's a reasonable inference to say that Newton was offended by this claim on levels more than that of just the cop and the criminal. I think this struck deep at his sense of the importance of understanding alchemy as a path towards understanding the divine.
Tom, everything you write about the mind, the imagination, the temperament of Isaac Newton makes me want to bring him into this world, even into MIT world. He is the architect of our thinking. I want you to walk him around the neighborhood that is built on his designs in a certain way. So many things happening here in computer sciences, in nanotechnology, in every kind of space exploration, physics, derived in so many ways from him. Where would you take him around here? And then how would you explain what's going on?
Unlike a lot of scientists or thinkers about nature from an earlier age who would confront the really extraordinary transformation of the world, and the transformation of our worldview that has occurred in the modern sciences, I think Newton would have taken to MIT like it was his personal playground. The things I think that would have caught his attention first are the things that were nearest to his heart in the problems he himself actually worked on, because some of those are actually, in critical ways, still active problems. He would have loved to know the sense we have made of the cosmos, astronomy, astrophysics, the understanding of, you know, an evolving universe that has a point that at which it began, has development, and is changing even as we speak, even as we talk about it. I suspect he would have been one of those who took the Big Bang as an analog to the moment of creation as described in the Bible. But I think the fact that the universe from, you know, end to end of the observable space that we have access to obeys a set of laws that are, to a quite good approximation, those same laws he arrived at several hundred years ago. And, you know, as you get to the largest scales and the highest speeds and all that, of course, Newton's laws become a special case of Einstein's laws. And as you get to certain kinds of reactions and developments of energy, we get into the world of the quantum, which was something he had absolutely no contact with. But on the very broad scale, you know, you look at the way the solar system goes around, and you look at the way the galaxy, moves, and you look at the way we can infer that there is dark matter because of its gravitational impact on the visible objects we can see, and all these different things that we can know about the universe from this, you know, great distance. I mean, the fact that we can get this knowledge from a distance. It was Isaac Newton who first said, we can know things as far from our immediate experience as a comet with a track that goes to infinity simply by our understanding of the laws of motion and the use of our powers of reason and the mathematical capacity that we're developing. So Isaac Newton would have loved that.
What are the things at MIT that would completely surprise him and shock him?
I think where he would have been most intrigued, perhaps horrified, possibly even deeply saddened, is in the revolution in the biological sciences, the sciences of mind and self. I don't think there was anything in 17th and early 18th century science, philosophy, or theology that really prepared anyone for the impact of Darwin, for the impact of Mendel, and for the impact of the truly rigorous application of the materialistic worldview to who we are, how our bodies work, how our minds work. And that's where I think he would have had the greatest difficulty, not necessarily comprehending the underlying ideas, but dealing with the success of the results of this extraordinarily important line of inquiry.
What is it that would trouble him? Is it the banishing of not only God, but of a deep mystery?
I don't think Isaac Newton wept much for the banishing of mysteries. I think he was committed to that as a proposition. But I do think he had a profound sense of himself as an agent of God. I mean, one of the scholars whom I most respect in this area and whose work I drew upon, Simon Schaffer of Cambridge, is writing now a book about angels in 17th century English thinking. And he argues persuasively to me that Newton saw himself as a kind of angel of the Lord. And it's very, very hard to hold on to that conception when you see how powerful the hypothesis that mind is a phenomenon of material brain. When you see how well that works, how much you can explain, how wonderfully we can intervene in the miseries of people using that as our basic presumption. The sense of a self that is not just autonomous from other selves, but that is autonomous from our physical substrate, that there is a self that is not just my body, but a self that is my ideas, my thoughts, my emotions, my feelings, is one that we all hold very deeply and that is being at least modified, if not entirely threatened, by modern neurobiology. And I think Newton would have found that difficult, very difficult. Many, many people do. He's not unique. I mean, he has plenty of company today. The most glorious thing to me as a person alive in the 21st century about the, in some senses, the final outcome of the Newtonian program is the extraordinary results of the combination of evolutionary and molecular biology. The fact that we really can see a unity to biological nature, that I can recognize as kin a yeast cell, I can recognize as part of my own history a bacterium growing in a mat on top of a stone made up of generations of bacteria that grew just that way, is to me beautiful. But I'm a 21st century person with a couple of hundred years of thinking about the interrelationship of living nature in that way. Isaac Newton came out of a time when the distinction between human life and all the rest of God's creation, over which man had been granted dominion, was very much more strongly expressed. And I think it would have been really tough for him to make that shift.
Newton's own definition of his work, and I'm quoting from your book, but I think it's in his Optics, left plenty of room not only for mystery but for God. And I wonder what has changed fundamentally. He said his project was to learn whence it is that nature doth nothing in vain and whence arises all that order and beauty which we see in the world. What's out of date about that definition of the project?
I'm not sure there's much out of date out of that. I mean, nature doth nothing in vain is an extremely powerful concept if you interpret it, as I think Newton probably did, at least some of the time, as trying to understand the underlying pattern of laws that permit or determine a particular series of events. So there's nothing random. It doesn't just happen. And that's broadly the program of science. We want to know why things occur. We want to be able to fix them in patterns. We want to be able to organize our understanding of nature into ideas of greater and greater abstraction that can be used to comprehend and calculate a broader and broader part of our experience. Newton, I think, also meant, however, something that is harder to maintain today, which is an assertion that the beauty that we perceive, that the design we experience in the universe, is the expression of the, I'm quoting from memory, and I'm misquoting from memory, you know, the all-powerful, all-present, you know, omnicompetent, active, present God physically here in nature. And he wanted to get through nature to that being. And that's not the central argument of modern science. And in fact, many would say, I included, that science as it's now understanding the world does not allow you to make a positive assertion about the existence of God. It gives, contrary to that, a very powerful chain of inference from which you can readily draw the conclusion that there is no God. But in terms of science as an investigation of the material world, providing the kind of affirmative encounter with God that Newton sought, that's not something that's available to us anymore. I don't think so.
I also want to know five people you'd want to introduce him to at MIT.
I can think of several people I'd like to introduce Isaac Newton to at MIT. Tim Berners-Lee.
Amen.
Guy who invents the World Wide Web to the extent that you can tie that albatross around any one person's neck. The notion, I think, it's been a dream, and Newton had it as well, this sort of ability for a mind or some minds to encompass all of human knowledge. Well, more than anyone else, Tim Berners-Lee has helped make that possible. Wolfgang Ketterle is somebody who is probably not a household name in the same way. He's one of MIT's Nobel laureates. He won his Nobel Prize for work done on exploring matter at its absolute coldest. He led one of the first groups to isolate what's called an Einstein-Bose condensate, at which you turn very cold stuff. They change from being individual atoms into being this sort of big meta, you know, agglomeration of a quantum object that is both wave and particle at the same time and can interfere with each other. And it's an insight into the fundamental characteristic of matter that was a deep passion. Trying to understand that particular question was a deep passion of Newton's. It was one of the reasons he was so interested in alchemy, was understanding what matter was made of, really. And we've got that right here. We got it, you know, I can walk you over to a building where there's this whole table full of lasers and lenses and so forth, where this, you know, extraordinary scientist who, like Newton, whom Newton would have loved because he was such a wonderful experimentalist. I mean, Newton's love of doing things right with your hands. Well, Wolfgang is one of those characters.
Where would you take him in nanotechnology? And then robots.
Well, for robots, if I could, I'd love to stage a cage match between Marvin Minsky and Rod Brooks for Isaac Newton's and my entertainment on robots now and the robotic future. Minsky is simply one of the most, you know, fertile, extraordinary intellectuals of the last half century. Has a sense of human-machine interactions, a society of machines in which humans can take part, all kinds of exciting things. And Rod is this, you know, guy fascinated by robots and their social relations to human beings. He's the one who's really pursuing the idea of humanoid robots. And, you know, these two brilliant men have deep disagreements about what the appropriate way to organize, you know, to place robots in our life might be. And I think I would certainly enjoy. I suspect that the Isaac Newton, at least of my imagination, would as well. You know, the argument about how we are supposed, as we make machines that are more and more like us in some respects, how we're supposed to live with them. I think he would have enjoyed that conversation.
Who would introduce Isaac Newton to the science of neural pathways, the intense and microscopic exploration of the wiring of the human brain, which until, you know, just a few years ago was considered an impenetrable black box?
Nancy Hopkins is obviously, you know, somebody who's doing really interesting stuff trying to understand, you know, how we think. One of the things I'd like to show Newton, almost as much as talking to someone, maybe even put him through it, I mean, wouldn't it be cool to stick Isaac Newton and his brain inside a functional MRI machine? Wouldn't you like him to ask him to sort of, you know,
start thinking about the planets and see what parts of the brain light up?
Yes, or I was thinking, you know, back when he was a kid, he would sort of obsessively calculate things. He would write out infinite series to, you know, digit after digit after digit. Have him start running some of those calculations in his brain and see that unfolding inside an MRI machine. I think that would be the coolest thing since canned beer.
Would Isaac Newton find anybody on the MIT campus who could talk with him about the first cause? About God?
Absolutely. Newton, you know, despite my own personal argument that modern science is not about God in the same way that Newton science was in some ways all about God, it is a mistake commonly made about the scientific community to assume that there isn't a large proportion of believers practicing science at the highest level, that there are people who, despite, again, my own views on it, believe in some form of the argument from design, or else simply feel that the whatever you may say about the unfolding of natural events, issues of first causes are not only not resolved by science, but are unresolvable about science and are explicitly resolved by appeals to religious thinking. There are plenty of people on this campus, in the School of Science, high up in the School of Science, amongst our student body, who have a very strong commitment to faith, both in very traditional forms and in the sort of more commonly held amongst the scientific community, deistic kind of approach to God as immanent in the universe, God as the expression of the laws that we observe in the universe, those kinds of things. Ranges from that kind of very abstract notion of God to, you know, Jesus, the Son of God, God the Father, the Holy Ghost as, you know, fully realized beings that are accessible, if not by, you know, a measuring device, by the human heart and by faith. All those things are present here as they are present throughout our society.
Isaac Newton, the prosecutor, was inflamed against the counterfeiters by this perversion, this blasphemous twisting of the decent, honorable science of alchemy. What is the chance that Isaac Newton, wandering around the MIT campus, would find what he thought was counterfeit science, or science that abused some fundamental understanding of who we are and what we're supposed to find out?
If Isaac Newton were to look all around MIT, all around sort of the expanse of modern science, and say, you know, this stuff is crazy. This stuff is delusion. This stuff leads you down the wrong path. I wonder, this may just be betraying my own prejudices here, but I wonder if he wouldn't take a look at the field of evolutionary psychology and say, you know, telling stories about the way people must be because of events that you aren't sure happened sometime in the distant past, sometimes so distant that the events occurred to creatures that were not human, that's a pretty big reach.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
There's a lot of stuff that gets written, particularly in sort of bad popular evolutionary writing, about how, you know, human beings are warlike because, you know, we clubbed each other on the head in the African savannah a million years ago. or that the roles as we experienced them, the gender roles as we experienced them in the 1950s, actually have a quality of inevitability to them, because deep in our evolutionary past, males were hunters and females were, you know, gatherers and nurturers or something. And there are a lot of people, you know, people who think seriously about questions of evolution and behavior. Most of them, I think, hate such cartoon versions, but there are plenty of those cartoon versions out there. And I think Newton, who had a very strong moral sense, would have been extremely sensitive to the need to say, you have to claim ownership of your own actions, your own choices, your own deeds, righteous or not. And as you build these stories on very flimsy strands of observation and evidence and a great deal of hypothesizing, you are actually asserting a real minimization of what it is to be human now. And I certainly see much of evolutionary psychology as a much less supportable field than I think its most avid practitioners do. And because I wrote a book that describes Newton as I can best understand him, my Newton would also see, I think, that field as very suspect.
There's another piece of Isaac Newton that MIT raises in my mind, and that's Newton is the president of the Royal Society. In his own day, he was at the center of this little incredibly elect group of Boyle, the greatest chemist of the day, Halley, the astronomer, John Locke, the philosopher, Christopher Wren, the architect. They all knew each other, and they surely talked intimately about their different worlds. Does this happen in the wonder world of MIT these days?
You know, the Royal Society was an extraordinary place and a brand new place when Newton was a young man. It was founded just when he was getting to Cambridge. And yes, indeed, later in life he became the president of it. And so I think when Newton would come to MIT, he'd look around here and he'd see several things that would be very familiar. First of all, this is a place that relies on a whole web of people making every experiment go, making every idea go forward. Secondly, Newton himself was an institution builder. He used his presidency of the Royal Society to seed the important positions in English and British intellectual life with people who understood his way of doing science, new science, mathematical science. And you look around at MIT and see a great big institution that always wants to be bigger, that wants to hire the best young engineer, the best young scientist, and he'd go, yeah, this is how it's done. He'd know what was going on here.
Would he still be the greatest mathematician on campus?
He'd have to hit the books a little, Newton would, to catch up to modern mathematics. No. I mean, realistically, nowadays there's so much more math, more physics, more stuff to know. It's very, very hard to imagine ever again anyone coming along standing astride of so much of human knowledge in one single extraordinary brain.
Tom, you make me feel he's in the room. Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed this book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, and I love to hear anybody talk about this man. Thank you, Tom Levinson.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Tom Levinson of MIT, whose new slice of history is titled Newton and the Counterfeiter. Our interns at Brown University, Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson, helped put this together. Fire up your own questions and answers about mind and body, about God and modern science at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.